equals burn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 of 200, the Politics and Media Podcast. We are doing some local and international politics today, like we do almost every week. I am joined by some co-hosts. Stephanie, how are you doing?
Kia ora, not too bad, bit croaky. Same old.
And Philip, how are you?
Kia ora, I am well. Croakiness seems to play well for us in the charts, Stephanie, so that's good. The episodes where someone's croaky are our best rated. I don't know if that's ASMR reasons or people listening while they go to sleep reasons.
Higher quality content because I don't want to talk too much reasons.
Oh no, don't say that.
Just distill it, yeah. And I'm Kyle, returning as co-host this week. If you want more independent media, check out our Patreon in the summary. We can take all the money and turn it into content for everybody. And we really appreciate everyone's support who's been with us over the last 7 years. Local politics, it's it's always a lot of fun to see the horrible, nasty people on the right wing turn on each other like rabid dogs trapped in a smaller than regulation space. And that seems to be what has happened this week with leaks to media. And I put leaks in air quotes because it just, a lot of the stuff feels like they're just talking to their mates. It feels like reporters who have just taken things for granted from right-wing politicians to attack the left have now been handed the next victim. And that's not to say I'm on the side of the person being targeted, Ray Chung, who has had emails released that he sent to some other councillors that are just foul. That are just like, you know, it's up there with the Cameron Slater, Jordan Williams level of, what's the euphemism? Locker room talk. Just really disgusting about women's bodies. Foul rumours about Wellington's mayor, Tory Fano. And the media have published it. And almost immediately you started seeing some of the financial backers for Better Wellington pull out of the campaign. I cannot help but think, though, like, good, I want this guy to be nailed, right? I don't think this dude should ever have been allowed to be in politics. It is very clear he's a bad actor. He acts in bad faith. He's nasty. But he's part of an ecosystem, and not to defend him, but it does feel like they're throwing him under the bus because they've realized that they shouldn't have made him the front man of their billionaire-backed, what do we call it? Independent and not political project.
Yeah. It's clearly, I don't know, look, yeah, the two things, I guess, that came out this week were the claim that he has, him or Independent Wellington have a dossier, if you want to pronounce it like that, on political opponents, which he's denied, and an email that he sent soon after he became a councillor in 2023 about not women's bodies, but like not to put too fine a point on it, like a sexist kind of rumour about Tory Fano, one of many kind of just salacious, gross sex fantasies peddled by a right-wing man in Wellington over the last few years, right? Early in that pattern. And the fact that this has come out after years at the same time as the other claim, I think is obvious that someone's trying to take him down. And like Kyle said, good, like he should be taken down. He's a psycho and it seems like an incredibly horrible person and has no place in our public kind of discourse. Like everyone in Wellington, what is this? Like the rest of the country also has right-wing freaks, but what is it about you people? Sort your...
Hey!
Take some responsibility, Steph.
I think, you know, sorry, we are a media critique podcast, so I can't help but point out that this is also where all of the press gallery are. So if you want the highest per capita concentration of journalists who are chummy with politicians, then, you know, that's why all of these things happen. You know, it's like how the whole Florida man meme is a result of Florida just having looser reporting guidelines for weird legal cases than the rest of the United States do. So that's why it seems like it always happens in Florida. That could be why it seems like it always happens in Wellington.
That is a bloody good point. It's the plane with the holes shot in it of national reporting, right? Like, yeah, it looks that way because those are the ones you see.
It hasn't gone unnoticed either that, you know, it was the Auckland's paper, The Herald, which also, not great, that was doing better reporting on this, while the Post, you know, under the Stuff umbrella, has regularly been the one doing a horrific Wellington reporting and feeding these rumors. So I think, yeah, I think there's definitely an aspect of that there, right? The access journalism in Wellington is just that more pointed, that more readily available. And there are just like more immediate kickbacks for people willing to peddle it.
Yeah, and that, I mean, this has obviously been pointed out, and I think we even talked about this before, but the whole idea of a slate of independent, quote unquote, independent candidates all running as a ticket together and supporting each other and sharing backers and stuff is such a laugh that it is really like the cherry on top of what we've seen for years in New Zealand is that in local government, the right run as independents because for some reason they think that makes them, I don't know, more appealing, and the kind of voters who vote for them say that they like people to be independent from government, and then you'll have, you know, Desley Simpson saying she's independent and then going to National Party dinners, and just like this is common like countrywide, not just in Wellington, but having a ticket called independent is like really just the absolute like cherry on top of this. It's the apogee of this system that we've fucking created in New Zealand and local government.
Was apogee your $5 word today, Philip?
No, that was whatever I said before. Dossier.
Dossier.
I'm doing words ending in air today. I'm doing French.
Nice. Yeah, I think so I definitely had a rant about this on Blue Sky, but I'm so over this whole idea that, you know, keep party politics out of local government, as though local government is just devoid of ideological considerations. And I think that that's obviously a deliberately fostered narrative. You don't want people thinking about how our parks and our libraries and our rubbish collection and our playgrounds are all fundamentally political projects, because the idea that there should be these public spaces or facilities that you don't have to pay to use and that you don't have to, you know, answer to a corporate overlord to maintain them in your neighborhood, that's a fundamentally political thing. But if we acknowledge that for these baseline services that everyone loves, well, then suddenly a whole lot of right-wing politics becomes a lot shakier. And there's been around the Wellington campaign from the Independent Together group, some, well, sorry, from one of their candidates, and then all of their other candidates are like, I support this statement, but also it's not my statement because we're not a political party. We're all just independent
It's so pathetic.
together. And they've literally been accusing Andrew Little, who at this point must be the clear front runner for Wellington mayor, of effectively having dual loyalties because he won't put Wellington ahead of the Labour Party. And it's just like, you mean he has clearly articulated values and policies, or like, and this is something that I've certainly criticized Tory Whanau for before, if Andrew Little renounced the Labour Party, somehow he wouldn't have been a union boss and a senior Labour Party cabinet minister, and all of those things that he's done and those politics that he clearly holds would somehow vanish, and you'd go, oh, well, he's definitely independent and just, you know, doing stuff based on the evidence instead of his ideology. Like, of course not. You know, and we saw exactly the same thing happen to Tory Whanau. She let her Green Party membership lapse early in her first term. And did that make the right wingers not send shitty emails about her? Oh, it did not. Did it increase council cohesion? No, it did not. I'm so over this cynical attempt to say that political things aren't political, because if we say they're political, then suddenly capitalism doesn't work anymore, basically.
100%. And maybe a minor digression, but I'm so over people saying that they're going to be a leader for all of insert spot here, right? Like Andrew Little saying, whether you vote for me or not, I'm going to be a leader for all of Wellington. That all that does is
From the left.
dilute the commitments you're making. Like either you have policy commitments or you don't. And if you're committing to lead people who disagree with those policy commitments, what does that imply about your commitment to that cause? Like that makes me trust you less as a leader if you say that. The Phil Goffery of I'm not running, you know, we had Phil Goff in Auckland for 2 terms as mayor, and he ran on a deliberately light blue branded independent I'm not the Labour Party ticket, and or not ticket, just himself, and won massive margins through name recognition and did nothing for 2 terms essentially, right? And as you'd expect, he's a conservative Labour Party kind of centre right dude who seems good at meetings and negotiation. which is, seems to be how Little's positioning himself. But the fact that you run and you go, look, I'm running to represent everyone, that's not a commitment. What are you going to do with the area that you're running to represent?
I mean, I hate to once again hand it to Matthew Houghton, but the smartest thing he ever said is that a lot of Labour politicians don't want power, they want office. And in that framing, then yeah, it does make sense that you're going to be the mayor for everyone because you're not willing to stand on anything proactive. And, you know, just to once again drop in, I don't know if you know, but I did run for Parliament in 2023. Have I mentioned it before? You're all shocked. I found that running as a Green candidate, obviously there were people who didn't agree with what the Green Party stands for,
What?
because they're wrong. But people did appreciate that I wasn't bullshitting them. And I wasn't going to go, oh, yeah, no, I will totally compromise those values I hold if it'll make you more comfortable. You know, some people will always be anti you, and don't waste your time trying to persuade them. But a lot of people will be anti you and still be able to respect you. And still be able to respect that you are an honest trader. And I think that that is just something that progressive candidates need to do more often. We need to stop apologizing for any of the things that we believe in, especially because they are correct, but also because people can sense the weaseliness and they don't like it.
I think it's a power move to say, don't vote for me if you don't agree with my vision for the city, right? Or your electorate or the country. If you're fundamentally against my beliefs and my plan, then don't support it. Like I'm running for what I believe in, not for you. Like I'm not running for you as this abstracted kind of notion of a country who all want the same thing. I accept that there's a segment of people who agree with me and a segment of people who don't, and there's a power dynamic inherent in that. And I want to increase the segment of people who believe in me, but I'm going to do that by showing that my vision works, not by lying,
The
you know.
problem is you have to have a vision to be able to do that.
Exactly.
You have to be offering something. You have to just be saying, like, I'm offering this and this. If you don't like that, then don't vote for me. But if you're saying, oh, we're gonna, fuck, what was that Atkins thing the other day? We need to take action on jobs, health, and cost of living. And you're like,
We have
yeah, but
clear
what do,
priorities, Carl. We have
yeah,
clear priorities for the country.
what are you doing? Like, what? My view has been for a while now that saying you're gonna be a leader for all is a right-wing ratchet politics tool. And I think it kind of peaked somewhat when Labour won an outright majority. And I think it was Robertson who got up and made the speech saying, oh, you know, this 5% or whatever came over from National that tipped us over the boundary here, and we're gonna pay that back too. And just like, why?
I
Like,
thought that was Ardern. That was Ardern, wasn't
I
it?
think it
I thought
was Ardern.
Robertson was the one who like really on the
fleshed that out.
night. In the Auckland Town Hall, I have a vivid memory, A, of Kelvin Davis giving the worst speech I've ever heard, followed by Jacinda coming out and then basically saying, those
Oh,
of you who
okay.
came over to us, we will not forget you. And I was just like, what are you doing? But yeah.
It's all
She
through that
did.
cohort, right, of the Labour leadership. But what it's saying is we're not actually going to be doing the things that we delivered on that got these votes in the first place. We're arbitrarily swinging back right to keep a cohort that is indefinable for, because we are right wing, on some level.
It's both. Ardern said it on the night, but also Robertson said it to a business audience. Kyle is probably what you're remembering, because he was saying, I know that a lot of you would have voted for Labour for the first time this year. Ha ha ha. We're here to represent you, which isn't what you were voted in on, as you say. Like you're voting for something. You're basically turning traitor. And I don't think it's inherently right wing. I don't think that's what you're saying, Kyle. But I don't think it's an inherently right wing phraseology. It's what it is fundamentally dishonest. Like you are saying that what I just ran on was a lie when you say that,
I mean, it's a
because
context thing, right?
it is. It just happens to be right wing because who does it is the Labour Party in New Zealand. And Key, to be honest, John Key was similar. When he won ex-Clark voters, he said, I'm here to represent Labour voters, and that's what got Matthew Hooton and the other kind of ideological right people offside with him straight away. Is that just shows, you know, I don't have an ideology, I'm here for the office. I'll just immediately throw anyone under the bus
And
and
boy,
stack them
wasn't
again.
he. He
Yeah.
was there for the office.
There you go.
I just want to drag us kicking and screaming back into the misogyny and local government discussion for a sec, because I just had two kind of more general points to make about it. And one was that Julie Ferry, an Auckland community board member, local board, I can't
Councillor.
remember how your
Councillor.
weird system works. Is she a councillor now? Awesome. Pointed out when the leak of Ray Chung's email occurred that previously Morris Williamson had been caught on a hot mic at a council meeting, also talking salacious nonsense about Tory Farno. And I just, because my brain defends itself by going big picture rather than focusing on the gross details of what I'm reading, I'm just struggling with the fact that having spent my whole life living in this goddamn patriarchy, being told that women get paid less and promoted less often and can't do math or science because our brains aren't serious enough, and yet here we have just conservative man after conservative man openly gossiping about a woman's alleged sex life, and I'm still meant to take them seriously. I'm still meant to go, well, they are people of mana and authority and credibility in my community, when frankly, women don't get away with that crap at all. I think at the same kind of, maybe within a day or two of this, the Post's front page was regurgitating details of Kerry Allen's car crash 2 years ago and what she said to the police. And like, that was the whole front page. That was the most important thing happening in Wellington that day, apparently. And the double standards are just so palpable, drives me absolutely over the edge. And we also have to tie this into what we are hearing from more and more women candidates in local government about how toxic and how abusive and how horrific it is. A good mate of mine, Louise Hutt, who's a Hamilton City councillor, is constantly talking about just how horribly abusive and negative even other members of council are, how deceptive people are in their framing of issues in a way that we know leads to abuse and violence. And like, not saying that this was a direct flow-on effect from that, but Julie Ferry herself was just injured while riding her bike because a car winged her, because I don't know if you know this, but cycling infrastructure in our major cities also sucks. And you go on Facebook posts about it, and it's just laugh emoji reactions. And it's just, well, what did you expect? It's just, you know, well, ha ha ha, that'll teach you for being a cyclist. Like, the narratives and the frames are so normalized in their toxicity and violence and abusiveness. And it is meaning that we are getting fewer and fewer women running in local government. We will get much fewer people from other marginalized groups running in local government because they don't want to deal with it. And we will be stuck with gossipy old conservative men who will not run our cities well. And it just is very frustrating, is the Saturday morning language I will use to describe my feelings on that matter.
And that's the intent, right? That's the intent of this. And it's why the media ends up kind of in our sights a fair amount, because ideally, you know, well, I say ideally from my point of view, which I know is not correct in terms of the structural power dynamics here, they are meant to be holding the stuff to account. They're meant to be going, okay, like maybe I shouldn't run day after day, week after week, salacious attacks. That have been fed to me by right-wing councillors to attack high-profile women candidates. It's just absurd this week with the Tory Farno coverage. For some reason, they brought back Kerry Allen as well. They're like, hey, time to do a best greatest hits. There's just no reason to be publishing that. Like at this point, it was not in the public interest at all. It's like they were linked by SEO and were like, oh, well, we're running Tory Whanau, we have to run Kerry Allen again as well. Time to attack as many Wahine Māori as possible. Just really weird stuff from the people who are meant to be or purport to be holding power to account. They're just not fit for purpose anymore. It's bizarre to see it day after day, and you know, in the last couple of years, that's become far clearer. But they really have shaken off any pretense that they're here to speak truth to power at all. I think, was it Tracy Watkins recently who claimed that? Yeah, I think it was. So over at Stuff, I think she is at the moment, saying that when they do this coverage of, for example, Tory Farno as the mayor of Wellington, it's actually speaking truth to power. And you're like, come on. Like, are you fucking kidding me? But I think, well, the thing that is most telling here, because we've seen a lot of this stuff happening previously, we know that this is the way that the media acts in terms of access journalism. With like some of the people publishing this stuff were the same people publishing it a couple of years ago. It's that this email that was that Ray Chung sent and has admitted to sending, and has now been leaked. Multiple people already knew about it. They've known about it for 2 years. It was sent in 2023, and the people involved in that current campaign decided to make him the front man anyway. And that means it's either because they didn't care about it until they did, or they saw it as effective compromise on him, and so felt like they held the reins. And you have to, like, that should be the story here, that this is a culture on the right wing of Wellington local politics that is okay with this kind of behavior, that maybe almost necessitates this kind of behavior to for their own power dynamics, that doesn't have any loyalty, even to their own people, and that it seems to be, like, it's hard to think that it's anything but rife within these spaces.
Yeah, exactly. I think yeah, that's the takeaway I had when I first saw the email leak. I was like, so is this disgusting now? And it wasn't disgusting 2 years ago, you know? So this is always the issue when something gets leaked years after it happens, is people have known about whatever it was for this length of time, right? And this isn't a team sport, right? We've criticized all these people on this podcast. We've criticized Tory Fano plenty. We criticized Kerry Allen while she had power. This isn't about individuals, right? This isn't a fucking, you know, we're on Team X, therefore we wouldn't criticize them. But it's about when you choose to make these claims and why it's just about the kind of easy target, the bloodletting that establishment media loves. You know, we were no friend of any of these people while they had power, but you can't just open the drawer and open a big folder called Brown Women and just start at the top and, you know, rehash the hits without taking some flack, I think justifiably. And yeah, the fact that obviously what seems like fellow travellers on the right have decided that Ray Chung is no longer fit for purpose or isn't going to win an election, which he wasn't going to anyway. Andrew Little is going to walk away with this without trying,
It's
right?
embarrassing they thought he could do anything in there. It's absurd that I think they basically made him the front man because they were all too cowardly. They're like, hey, let's send up this like barely functioning weather balloon.
Yeah, but it's about Overton with window shifting, right? Shifting right in both senses of the word, like axe running candidates and local body is we're already seeing that deliberate kind of pulling of the Overton window of what you can expect from local government, which has been, you know, anemic and underfunded forever, at least what, 20 years. We just haven't spent stuff in places that's needed stuff spent. And then someone like Tory Fano gets in and says, oh, maybe we should fix some pipes. And everyone freaks out because everyone wants to live in a, you know, tsunami of feces running down Cuba Street, filling the bucket fountain with, you know, whatever Ray Chung left in his toilet the night before. But yeah, that this is like a systemic, deliberate kind of underfunding to keep that screwed down and running like local personalities around the country as the ACT Party is trying, but hilariously kind of failing to do through not picking up candidates, is definitely kind of a deliberate strategy, right?
Yeah, the interesting thing is like it looks like the ACT is already spending a fair amount of money as well to target particularly Northland with digital ad spend. So they're going to try and do what they did in the national election, but I don't think they've really reckoned with the way people turn out to vote in locals. And as you've said, like the ACT party is uniquely unpopular, and so is David Seymour. And I just don't think they really understand that still. And they've kind of thought, oh, we can just get anyone on board, and the people they're getting are lunatics. Like they're creating the environment for entryism for people that are worse than they are, and it's like I hope it blows them up. I hope it blows them up. I hope they are overreaching here. The problem is, and I've said this elsewhere, is that it kind of, on some level, without a really organized progressive bloc, it doesn't matter too much. Like the big conspiracy groups don't need to get people elected. They need to get ACT to pick up one or two of their policies, right? They need to get New Zealand First to pick up one or two of their policies. And they've been incredibly successful at that under a national coalition, which just lets them do it because there are as many lunatics in the National Party who are at least think they've got it on a leash, right? And we're seeing this kind of stuff with the regulatory standards bill as well, is that ACT and New Zealand First are there to like accelerate the Overton window out. And to the extent that I think talking about just Overton window shifting is probably not like a useful way to frame it anymore because it's radicalization. It's active radicalization at this point for communities, for individuals, and for the institutions of government, and particularly the media as well. And a really clear example that's happening this week is that the ACT Party has brought this guy over to talk at their conference called James Lindsay. Have you done the background on this guy, Philip? Minimal.
I've got a wee summary.
Yeah, give it to us.
Okay, so I first of all have to say that I am indebted to my second favorite podcast, I Don't Speak German. They are great guys who do an immense amount of explaining of the far right movement. And yeah, if you ever want to be ahead of the curve of what our local Nazis are going to do next, then it is the podcast to listen to. They are great. So James Lindsay, always referred to as Dr. James Lindsay by his right-wing friends who don't actually respect academia but like to use the tools of power to give themselves credibility. Kind of initially, I guess, gained infamy through what I can only describe as the conceptual penis paper, which he and another couple of right-wing academics decided to prove that feminist theory is bullshit and academic journals are not credible by writing a whole bunch of fake papers and submitting them to journals. And some of them got published, and they declared victory at this showing that, you know, you can write any old bullshit and get it published in feminist academic journals. However, part of the problem is that a lot of the articles didn't get published, and a lot of them that were published, the peer review process that journals go through isn't designed to catch people who just lie about their data. Like, that is something that the peer review process cannot do, otherwise nothing would ever get frickin' published. And my second favorite one is the one that they peddled and many media outlets reported as, we took a chapter of Mein Kampf, but we made all of the words feminist instead of Nazi, and then it was, you know, people published it and it was fine. It's like, well, yeah, but you took out all of the words with any fascist meaning. It would be like if I took the Communist Manifesto and replaced all mentions of workers with flavors of ice cream, and then went, look, ice cream is communist now. Like, completely meaningless bullshit. But of course, no one actually looks at primary sources. The conceptual penis paper, though, is my favorite, not just because of the phrase conceptual penis, but because, to quote the Wikipedia page on it, the paper argued that the penis should be seen as, quote, not an anatomical organ, but as a social construct isomorphic to performative toxic masculinity. Now, this is obviously people who don't understand feminist theory just throwing feminist jargon at things and being like, ha ha, tee hee, we're saying penises aren't real. I'm really enjoying, I'm so sorry, this is an audio medium, but Kyle's increasingly uncomfortable expression, the more I use the word penis, is really something to see. We need to put that behind a paywall. But what's really funny to me is that if you do know feminist theory, and a lot of second wavers would disagree with this, but you can kind of see how the paper has a point. Like, the physical structure of a dick is not what creates patriarchy, and that's not the source of sexual violence. And again, like, okay, your Andrea Dworkins might disagree and be a bit more biologically essentialist about it, but actually it's kind of interesting to think about the ways in which phallic things are imbued with power in our society. The first thing I think of whenever I think about this, because I'm a freaking nerd, is the scene in Alien where Ash tries to choke Ripley with a rolled up magazine, and the amount of serious critique and analysis that has been done on this, and about how, you know, spoilers for a, what, 50-year-old movie, Ash is a robot. He presumably does not have a penis. Why is he attacking a woman in this particular way? How can we see this imagery as being reflective of power dynamics? Blah, 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 blah. It's really interesting stuff to get into. And these guys are like, ha ha ha, so stupid. And it just shows the intellectual poverty of that part of the right wing. They don't understand the words feminists use, therefore, feminist theory is dumb because ladies should just get in the kitchen. Anyway, I've said the words conceptual penis enough for this episode.
Are you sure? I think you could probably fit it in a couple more times.
A few more uses of conceptual penis, Kyle. Oh God, that sounded like that was your nickname. Are you now conceptual penis, Kyle? I won't mind if that one gets edited out. That might just lead to too many hilarious replies to you on Blue Sky. The other thing to know about James Lindsay is that he is just your bog standard, shitty, far-right American pseudo-academic who sits on Twitter all day. He's one of the group who really pushed the groomer framing for gay people. He has said that if we don't abolish critical race theory, it will lead to white genocide. He's just one of your typical unserious fascists who doesn't mean anything he says, but he's understood that there's a grift and money to be made from it. And of course, people like our local ACT party, who are also incredibly unserious and even less critical in their thinking, are like, this is so cool. When he says things that are patently wrong and also create an environment where violence can happen, it triggers the libs. Ha 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 ha. And so they've brought him over to talk to their, apparently not AGM, apparently it's a party rally now because they can get more than 15 people into one room now, it seems.
I think that's a really important point, right? Is they're bringing this guy over because they think it's going to be good for clicks on some level. But at the same time, this is unlike, say, the usual suspects for bringing these kind of people over, the Taxpayers Union or the Free Speech Union, who've brought over some pretty nasty folks in the past. This is ACT really trying to move in on that fascist electorate. Like, this is some of this is normally more New Zealand First stuff. Some of this is usually in those like much smaller parties, like the Voices for Freedom cutouts, or Democracy NZ, or Brian Tamaki's stuff. The ACT Party has accidentally, and even the National Party, have accidentally flirted, accidentally is in air quotes, with the white genocide stuff when they've done immigration policy or whatever, right? But this guy is very clearly believes that stuff, and the ACT Party is saying we want to put this guy on a platform. He is very openly homophobic. He is very no, and like homophobic doesn't even like really describe what he's like about queer people. He is
The
exterminationist, right? Like.
Southern Poverty Law Center says James Lindsay regularly shares conspiracy theories about the supposed communist takeover of the world, especially the United States, promotes groomer rhetoric against the LGBTQ community, and spreads a white genocide theory that Marxists want to eradicate the white race. With alarmism and fear-mongering, Lindsay incites and segregates his base.
So this
And
is.
has a long history of going far beyond mocking and inciting violence against queer people.
So this is ACT saying, hey, we've really enjoyed doing stochastic terrorism. Let's take it up a notch. This is. Remember, there was quite a big public outcry when Stephen Molyneux and Lauren Southern were here. This guy's actually worse than them. He's got much more of a history of it. He's on the grift, but he's, I think, significantly more established. And they were both like a bit of a flash in the pan comparatively. And also the ACT Party wasn't directly like employing them to come and talk to a political rally, right? This is, David Seymour is the Deputy Prime Minister at the moment, and this is who he personally has chosen to come and speak to the party faithful. I think it's a anyone who is in this space, in the media politics space, is incredibly remiss. Like they're irresponsible not to be talking about this clear extreme shift in the way that politics is comported in this country. I'm struggling to grasp like a time where it's clearer that the ACT Party is pinning a flag to a mast.
I think the interesting thing about this kind of choice is it forces a distinction between the always dishonest but pervasive kind of free speech rhetoric from David Seymour and the kind of classical liberal ilk, and making a choice to do this, right? You have a world full of wanky right-wing public intellectual types, and if you choose one who is illiberal, which he is, he's anti-liberalism, he's right-wing, he's authoritarian, he's anti things like libraries choosing to do drag queen story hours, which in New Zealand has recently resulted in literal violence and a mob attacking queer people, then that shows your priorities, right? And as always, David Seymour and the kind of that side of the ACT Party, the the Van Veldens, the people who would like to style themselves as smarter kind of scions of the right, would defend that by saying free speech. But this isn't a free speech question. This is a question about who you're choosing to listen to and why. And there are smart people on the right, and the fact that you're choosing to pick someone who's not a smart person on the right and is explicitly against ideas like free speech and secular society where people have different views and can express them shows that there's a nasty undercurrent to that kind of belief, as there always was, and as we've always been saying. And this is when the ACT Party does well, as I've always said, is when they're not a liberal party, because they're not. They are a hard right-wing party, and they do better when they play culture war bullshit and attack minorities. And this is just a, an expression of that, honestly, as opposed to how they advertise themselves.
Yeah, I think you're right. And as I said, it's usually, one of the astroturfs bringing over one of these people, and then the ACT Party gets to sit on the sidelines and, as you say, go like, oh, look, we have all kinds of people come to this country. Look, if you don't like what they said, don't turn up to listen to them or engage in reasoned debate with them. But this is, yeah, this is pulling that further into the party fold.
You can't say it's all about free speech when that's the one person you choose. I mean, come on, that's fucking stupid. How dumb do you have to think the public are to say if you disagree with them, simply debate them? And you're, I assume, what, paying for his flights to come over here? Bastion of brilliant thought. I hadn't put two and two together and realized this was the grievance studies dude, but that is so funny. Like, this was debunked as soon as it came out, the grievance study stuff. That is so funny that that's the person in 2025. Are we still doing this? This isn't Tumblr era. Come on, grow up. Embarrassing.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to look at the ACT Party's motivations here. And one, which is, tainted with a slight bit of left-wing copium, is they know that they're not popular. Or, they probably tell themselves, oh, we actually are popular, but people are just too scared to vote for us. So they know that they need to scrape together 5% because everything they've done has been deeply unpopular. They are probably single-handedly sinking this government. I mean, hilariously, Winston has not managed to actually do near as much damage to this coalition that David Seymour has. And so they're also probably trying to get a lot of New Zealand First voters to switch over to them too. And so they don't care that this is obviously hypocritical, stochastic terrorism, enabling abusiveness, dishonesty, etc., etc. But then there's also the thing that we constantly harp on about, which is how the media consistently normalizes everything David Seymour does and treats his arrogant, smug little rejoinders as though they are serious political commentary. So
Or
there is an
hilarious.
element, or hilarious, he's so funny and he's just not. Again, I go to the mediocrity of conservative men that we're expected to treat with credibility and authority when, like, no, he gets awkward dying room laughter. That doesn't mean he's a comedian. So there is an element where, like, I'm just waiting to find out, is RNZ going to 9 to noon? James Lindsay, are we going to get like serious media?
Yes,
Because, he does have
they will.
doctor in his name.
Yes, they will. Honestly, someone will do the fucking Patrick Gower thing and interview him as though he's a serious political commentator. Absolutely, yes. And he will lie and he won't get called out on it. Nothing's improved over the last fucking 8 years of establishment media. I'm sorry to
Again, though,
leap
this guy
in.
is like, if they do that, that's
They
a
will.
watershed for New Zealand media as well. That's like a that will be a clear new low.
I don't know. I don't think he's worse. Honestly, I don't think he's worse than Molyneux and Southern. He's
And in
the same to
2025,
me.
though,
I mean, yeah, that's the thing, is
that's
that
right. That is the context
people should have
dependent.
learned this lesson, is that, I mean, these people are doing the same thing, right? It's all grift all the way down. Like, he's getting money from the same backers, the same funders. The entire thing is just, this is his job, is to speak at rallies. And I mean, the fact that it's called a rally, right? Or like a party gathering. It's not an AGM now. It's a cough Nuremberg AGM. Yeah, there is a nasty kind of undertone, I think, to the fact that that's not just the person they choose, but the people that they're clearly listening to and saying have good ideas, like Mihi Forbes's investigation into David Seymour and his connection with right-wing Canadians. had similar kind of implications that these are the people that he takes seriously, and David Seymour predictably, kind of said, oh no, this is like a crazy conspiracy, or ran out the John Key talking about Mickey Hager like sound bites. But as you would, right? Like these people are connected to genuinely nasty people. They're not common sense center-right liberals who just care about fiscal conservatism. They have a really nasty kind of philosophical, ideological bent towards reactionary racist freaks. And like that is a normal thing to say. That is what probably, you could say that is what most people would think if they knew these things. But I'm going to sound deliberately conspiratorial because I
Wonderful.
think it's appropriate. There is a closed cabal of establishment media acceptance for these things, in that you're not allowed to phrase things in those terms, right? You're not allowed to say David Seymour, when it comes to his ideas, his priorities, and his ideology, prioritizes the views of far-right, reactionary, racist, anti-minority, anti-queer, anti-Indigenous people above academics who are classical liberals and who have ideas about how to reorient the spending of the state, for example, which is what, that's who ACT would have brought over 20 years ago, right?
I don't think it's conspiratorial. Let's just clear on the evidence.
Oh, Kyle, our old battle. It is both conspiratorial and it is clear on the evidence. It is a conspiracy. It is a literal conspiracy.
Absolutely.
And it's true. Don't get me started.
Yeah, okay. Conspiracies can be real, folks. They don't have to happen in back rooms. They can just decide to do these things. Yeah, and I think the fact that we haven't seen coverage of the fact that the ACT Party is platforming this guy in a negative framing is pretty good evidence of that, right? Like, this should be big news that this outwardly liberal free speech guy is platforming this horrific human being. Let's move overseas. We've talked a bunch about the way that both the right wing and I guess, the centre left, particularly Labour, present themselves to the electorate, right? And we've seen the right wing accelerating to the extreme right with what they're happy to pull the mask away for and what ideals they're happy to stand alongside. At the same time as we've seen centrist, well, the secondary neoliberal party, often the Labour Party or in Canada, the Liberal Party. What's the right word? Give things away. Move, shift right, shift the Overton window right themselves, while not pinning things to the mast. Choosing to do this, oh, we're a party for all New Zealanders, we're a party for everyone in Britain, Canada, etc. Which in the last couple of years has also meant they're doing the pro-genocide stuff as well. But in the UK in particular, we have seen a very interesting shift in the last week with the somewhat establishment of a new political bloc. I'm not going to say political party just yet. That seems a fair bit more comfortable with being outspoken about what it wants to do with power. And this is on the back of a UK Labour Party under Keir Starmer that has gone further right wing than the previous Tory parties, especially in relation to freedom of speech. They've just proscribed Palestine Action, which is just an absolutely absurd thing to be doing. And this week,
For
vote.
our New Zealand listeners, proscribed is a word used in the UK to designate illegality. It's not a pharmacy thing. It's not that you have
I
to
didn't
do a
say
little bit of.
prescribed.
Well, it sounds the same in our bullshit
New
accent.
Zealand vowels, man, they're all just a schwa.
And we've just cut UK Labour, the Workers' Party, has just cut funding to a whole bunch, like healthcare funding to a whole bunch of the most impoverished people in the country. And Zara Sultana has maybe somewhat unilaterally decided to pull Jeremy Corbyn into the creation of a new political entity while resigning from the Labour Party, which I think is fantastic. And it's just immediate, like I say immediately, but she really hasn't stopped trying to stand up for working people all this time. You know, she's been on the outside. I think she had the whip removed by Labour, but is now a kind of co-leading this new political group and just going all in. Like, no, we shouldn't be claiming that activist groups like this that are anti-genocide are terrorists. We shouldn't be cutting these funding. We shouldn't be doing austerity, doing actual left-wing shit and being incredibly open about it in a way we haven't seen since Corbyn, and are already posting up, I think, about 10% on vote share.
I mean, you're a lot more bullish on this than me, I think.
I mean, is
Also,
bullish right? I don't
well,
know.
let's find out. Let's find
Maybe.
out. Like the latest news I saw on this is the Unite Union suspending Rainer's membership, which is interesting, and critics publicly saying that it's going to reevaluate its relationship with the UK Labour Party, which would be a massive deal because that's a huge funding source and they would have to treat seriously. And people have been wondering about that since Starmer kind of came in, about how far union alienation would actually mean something, and funding would be potentially quite a domino to fall. Obviously, Keir Starmer's been a very conservative leader of the Labour Party, lots and lots of leftists, or however you want to describe them, the left side of the Labour Party in the UK have had the whip removed and been pretty much entirely disempowered by the party. All of the former kind of Corbyn centric people have been, and I totally understand Zara Sultana's frustration, and I'm sure, you know, if we were in the UK, we would feel the exact same, that it's just bullshit that the UK Labour Party has gone so conservative, like in every aspect, right? Socially, with their like anti-trans stuff, they've pretty much fully bought into the anti-trans rhetoric from the TERF lobby, not just socially, like racial, the small boats rhetoric. They've gone way further than, like, Ed Miliband was criticised for doing some anti-refugee stuff, but they've really like gone hard in on that stuff. Economically, obviously, with the like first the winter fuel payments cuts, not first, famously with that, which they then have recently kind of regretted and turned around on, but these huge kind of benefit, brutal benefit and disability allowance cuts, just like huge right-wing turns that would, you know, if the Tories did it, you would be like, yeah, that is what you stood on. But it's just like absolute bald-faced turning in the like exact spitting in the faces of the exact people who thought you were going to stand up for you, right? So totally, like if I was Zara Sultana, I might have done the same thing. But across living on the other side of the world, it's not the way to start a political party. By roping somebody, by claiming that someone is your co-leader when they've explicitly been anti-co-leadership in public multiple times in the past, and also in the process of like creating a party, albeit at an incredibly glacial pace that will never like reach the acceleration required. You can't just put like I can't just write a press release that's like, Kyle and I have decided that One of 200 is now a Trotskyist entity.
Oh, of all the things, I was like, actually,
I
if you're
know.
going to say political party
But
or
that's why I had to
XYZ.
but that's why I had to pick something that I know you've explicitly denounced in the past, right?
Yeah,
Which Corbyn has, right? You can't do that. That is absolutely verboten, and way to make an enemy of at least 25% of the people who would have been your party members. So like I think strategically it was a bad choice. Absolutely understandable. Like I might have made the same, what I think is a mistake, if I was in that position, because like these people must be at the end of their tether, right? Like how frustrating would it be in the UK right now to be on the left and previously kind of Labour aligned? But there are all these people with like decades and decades steeped in Big L Labour, like the John McDonnell, for example, right? Like these people, I don't know if you'll ever tear them away from the party completely. And they're Diane Abbott, right? Just absolute legends of the left, who also like grew up with the Labour Party as an institution that meant something. Like, of course, you'd like there's something really deeply personal about these people's connections to the left, and you can't just suddenly say, I mean, you can't just do a new Labour, right? It's different over there. I don't know. What do you feel, Stephanie?
I don't know. I just struggle constantly with the fact that the UK is still stuck in fucking first past the post. Because what the hell? I mean, you're a backwards little nation, but really, there's got to be a line, guys. I would not have lasted 5 fucking minutes under Keir Starmer's leadership if I were a Labour MP over there. So I can see why she did it. I've certainly seen the viewpoint that maybe Jeremy Corbyn, for very valid reasons, is a little, gun shy, and maybe Zara was just like, "Fuck it, mate, I'm putting it out. You can either jump on or not. I don't care anymore. I'm so pissed off by this." And that is 100% what I would have done. So if it's a strategic error, it's a strategic error. I would co-sign. I mainly think it's a good thing because of how many of the British media immediately jumped to, well, this is just going to hand victory to reform. It's like you honestly cannot even see a world in which people would go for this. You cannot countenance any suggestion that there could be an alternative left-wing party that is viable. Like, they're so mad about it that she must be onto something. Also, her name's Zara Sultana, and that's a great party leader name. That just the merch just
Yeah,
creates
if Corbyn doesn't want to
itself.
be co-leaders, just be deputy. Problem
Be
solved.
deputy. And also
Honestly, yeah. She
that
should have,
would
like, that's what
be
she
a
should
great
have said, is
structure.
I'm forming a new party and I'm inviting Corbyn to be my deputy.
Yeah.
And I, like, if I were in the UK, I, like, to be clear, I do think it's good. Like, they do need to form a new left-wing party, or at least, like, at the bare minimum, I think it's probably too late to target the next election for a big tent kind of left
I don't know.
party
Look
in
at
the UK.
Reform's vote share.
Yeah, but that's not a new party, right? That's a reformation of UKIP, and Farage has been doing that with billionaire backing for over a decade. Like, that this was a long time in the making, right? But if I was on the left in the UK, I would be recommending more of, like, an alliance of small parties. Like, you have the Greens, you have a bunch of these anti-genocide independents who are pretty organized and are probably going to retain their seats, barring a turn left from the Labour Party. That just isn't going to happen. Sorry, lefties in the Labour Party, it's not going to happen. And you probably do need a new left-wing entity. Whatever incredibly slow, frustrating bullshit Corbyn comes up with will probably be, like, independent plus plus, which is fine. And, like, I think just write a small constitution for yourself. Be like, agree on these four principles. Some equity stuff, a vague kind of socialist agenda, and some peace and justice stuff, and then go, look, this is what it would take to be part of this alliance, and then agree on who's running for which seat and have a non-aggression pact, basically, right? I think that would make a lot more sense than forming a new, like, big P political party at this point.
Unless they can get the union money, in which case, go
Yeah.
for it.
I mean,
Yeah.
that's the big swinging potential,
I
right?
think that's part of the strategic calculus, right? I think the issue that the non-Corbyn wing probably faced is that they need Corbyn, and they need what he's been doing in his name rec and his history with Labour and his connection to Momentum initially, and just his ability to mobilize voters in the UK. And he wasn't. He wasn't moving. He was trying to set up this this NGO. He was always trying to work with the Labour Party, and the Labour Party treated him absolute bad faith, and until they kicked him out, and then he beat the Labour Party. And I don't think he was ever going to pull the trigger. I genuinely don't. I think he was always going to try and hint at it and maybe do it, but I don't think he was actually going to start a new party. And if you need him, and you're a young up and comer who really does believe in this, you need to find a way to force him to. And I think Sultana definitely did that. So I can't, I genuinely can't fault it on that grounds. The
I
other issue.
disagree. I disagree purely for the, like, I agree about all of your premises, but I disagree that this has forced him to. I think in a few months he will still be distancing himself,
We'll
and
see.
yeah, this is, I think this is what the difference will be, is I just think the strategic calculus is off. Like,
Okay.
I agree entirely with all your premises, and I possibly would have done the same thing, but I don't think this will endear him to the cause. Like, he does need to be dragged kicking and screaming. As he was into running for leadership, right? Like, he didn't
Yeah.
want to run for leader when
Yeah,
he
and this is the
initially
thing,
became
right?
leader, and he wouldn't have if he thought he was going to win, probably. And that's his personality. And you're right. Like, unfortunately, he is an asset that is absolutely required. But I just think this will backfire, not in terms of any of that optics bullshit, but in terms of that, I don't think this
He's going
will
to be too
make
cold on
him
it.
part of that movement. Yeah, and he'll stay as distant as he can possibly make himself. But we'll
Yeah.
see. I hope I'm
We'll
wrong.
see. I hope you're wrong too, because I want to be right. I think the other thing to keep in mind is, and this is, I'm going to do my own conspiratorial bit here, Philip. We know that when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, there was a right-wing cohort that moved around him and was feeding him intentionally incorrect information and spending money in places that weren't strategically viable to protect their own. And I suspect that there were remnants of that still around him, and is part of why things leaked so quickly to the media about his cold feet on this. And I suspect that also they're part of the reason that he's been so gun shy. Not like, obviously, it's his personality as well, but I think there's probably at least one person who was advising him about this stuff that was like psyoping him. And we know there's precedent for that. We know they were organized, and we can assume that they were organized enough to leave someone behind and not have them pull the mask off when Corbyn was excised from the Labour Party. So I think the secondary effect of this is that potentially some of that has been flushed out, and you've got the opportunity to coalesce around someone other than Corbyn, which you didn't have previously. No one else has been able to become a centerpiece for that kind of left-wing energy, while Corbyn has been there not choosing to do anything. So we'll see how that works. What it has shown, though, I think, and this comes on the back of Zoran Mandani's primary win in New York City as well, just came out that he got the most votes of anyone in history in a New York City mayoral primary. Is that the left probably can just say what they're going to do, and their voters appreciate that. And I'd say that goes for the base voters, like the core support, and goes far beyond that, given what we know about the way this has been effective all the way since Bernie Sanders. And that a lot of the, like, I don't know if appeals is the right word, but the criticism that, like, oh, but like Sanders has like racist workers voting for him or whatever, is just to poison the well. Like, this messaging works, standing on your values and principles works. And I'm interested to see how it works in the UK. Do we think that even if that should work in the UK, as it's worked in some local, more local elections in places like New York City, which is still, massive compared to New Zealand? Carney in Canada, he's obviously turned around like Keir Starmer did, but he promised like some pretty progressive stuff and was putting progressive stuff up before the election even occurred that got him over the line. Will the Labour Party in New Zealand look at that and go, oh, we should probably be doing that as well, before then turning around and doing austerity? Or do you think they're just like not capable of it at this point?
So that was my cue to talk about Chris Hipkins.
It's Chris Hipkins
It's
hour.
Hipkins
Ding, ding,
time.
ding.
Please put a time code in the show notes for people who want to skip Stephanie yelling about Chris Hipkins. But seriously, I think he is a major obstacle to them trying this, because we are only, or by the time of the next general election, we will only be 3 years out from a government in which he was a senior leader, in which he was briefly prime minister following Jacinda Ardern's resignation. I think to pull, even cynically, to pull the I'm going to campaign on progressive values that I don't actually hold, you can't be tainted by the previous administration that you were part of. Keir Starmer could come in as something of an unknown, a new figure, someone who hadn't been in that leadership position before. The Conservatives had been in for freaking ever, largely because the right wing of the Labour Party sabotaged Jeremy Corbyn. But Keir Starmer could look like a different face, and I think Carney could look like a different face, and Zoran Mamdani is obviously a different face and actually believes things. But I don't believe that, and I my antipathy for Chris Hipkins, well documented, but I think even if we had a transfer of power from Ardern to Robertson, the same thing would have applied. It is too easy for the right to take anything progressive Labour does and say, well, why didn't you do it 3 years ago? You had an unqualified majority 3 years ago and you didn't do this. How have you just had this great idea now? And maybe that works for, like, the Helen's Clark of the political discourse to come along, God, 30 years later and be like, I'm setting up a foundation to push all these progressive policies that, were around when I was prime minister. But Labour can't do it without a new face at the helm. And that is, even if it was a face I preferred more than Chris Hipkins's, I also don't think they'll try, because I've seen the narrative internalised so much within our Labour Party that all of their triangulation, centrism, reaching for middle New Zealand nonsense, we'll see it worked because Jacinda Ardern scraped through and became Prime Minister by appearing more progressive and also Winston deciding to make her PM. They've internalised that as the triangulation paid off. So I don't think they are capable of learning that lesson, to be honest, unless they've got different strategists, unless they've got a real willingness to have a proper fight and to not just sit back and go, well, David Seymour's tanking this government for us. Do we really need to try that hard?
A pretty funny thing that someone passed on to me who had read the Ardern biography is that Ardern, she wouldn't say it outright, but she agrees. Because in there, she has a go at Cunliffe for not resigning fast enough after losing that election. Like, apparently this is like something that was kind of against like the way that Labour was meant to work internally. And you can only ask like, okay, does that apply now with Hipkins? Because he is, he's a loser. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Like, if we're just gonna like put it out flat, like, hey, I lost to Chris Luxon. I think I have another go. Like, if the right wing here gets any more Trump-like, that's just what they're gonna run. Like, do you want this loser? Like, this guy's gonna put your hopes and dreams on the policy bonfire and lose. Like, this guy lost before, he's gonna lose again. Like, that in itself should just, like, if you are a functioning political machine, you cannot have someone that compromised as the leader of your party. I'm sorry. Like, it's just like, if he was a better man with better politics, I'd be sad about it. Like, he'd be like, ah, man, but he should have another go.
I also have to say, and this is not just because of, DEI box ticking exercises, but I just think having two white men called Chris going head to head for the top job,
That's embarrassing.
when our media is still so caught up in that kind of presidential style of its National versus Labour head to head, I just think it doesn't inspire people. It doesn't make politics seem interesting. It reinforces the idea that there's not much difference between who wins and who loses. And you need, especially if you were trying to do the progressive push, you need someone who, frankly, looks and sounds a bit different.
We need someone
Even
called.
if that is Kieran McEnulty with his beard and his ute, it's, not just another white man in a suit.
We need a David back, is what you're saying, right? It's
No
been
more
too long.
Davids. No,
Return.
we've had our quota of
Traditionalist.
Davids. No more Davids. I'm banning Davids.
Stephanie, there are only like six names for white guys. You're really
Oh,
limiting.
that's funny. Maybe we just shouldn't have a white guy.
I don't think Kieran's on their list, actually, so we're probably okay. Yeah, I think Stephanie's exactly right. Like, in terms of both like strategy and optics, and it is an absolute like disaster to run as someone who's a loser, but not just at election time, right? Like, I think, to be clear, I don't think there's anything deeply wrong with running a second time after losing an election. It's not just about losing the election. It's about having a stink of loserdom on you from the previous administration, right? Like, Chris Hipkins was the guy who had to eat shit when Ardern had to do something unpopular, right? Like, he was the attack dog who had to
I
stand in front
said
of
it
people and
before.
say unpopular things. And you can't get that stink off you, mate. Like, this is your job and you signed up for that role. You can't be the minister of everything unpopular in one administration and then immediately switch to being a soft presidential touch, the everyman who eats sausage rolls, and just expect people to forget that. Like,
Yeah, people
it's
are like,
incredibly hard to move on from
what's he
that
going to do with that
position.
sausage roll? Is he going to stab someone with it?
Minister of Police slash sausage rolls slash corrections slash education. Yeah, it's just it's gross, right? Like, he's not the person. And just beyond personality, like, yeah, the Labour Party needs a new face beyond comms and optics. They need to actually announce something. And National have cottoned on to this now, right? Within the last week, the new National attack line is, what does Labour stand for? I've seen multiple National MPs, they must have talked about this in caucus, coming out in different interviews or different
They listened to the
social
podcast,
media.
mate. They listened to the
They
fucking
do.
podcast, didn't they?
Hey, Chris Pink, I hear you. I see you out there.
No more Chris's. No, no more Chris's.
Not as leader, Jesus Christ, can you imagine? But like they're correct to point out that Labour doesn't stand for anything because they don't. And they keep saying we will announce our X strategy before the next election. But they've been saying that since the last election. And they said that for half of the term before. So like what do you
Their
stand for?
strongest
Nothing.
policy announcement has been, no, we don't like the Greens' alternative budget. We have other ideas. They go to a different school. I also think, and I hate this kind of political commentary, so I'm just going to indulge in a little bit of horse race optics nonsense for a second.
Fantastic. Hear
But
here first, folks.
there is a real issue for Chris Hipkins in that I don't believe I've ever heard prior to the Ardern government, I don't believe I ever heard anyone say he is a future leader of the Labour Party. And that shouldn't matter. We should not have anointed lines of succession in political parties. That is just how you get institutional capture. But it is a real thing that, you know, I think certainly, I mean, God knows, people have been saying about Chloe Swarbrick since before she became an MP. People were saying it about Luxon as soon as he became an MP. People have been saying it about Kieran McEnulty ever since they learnt he had a ute on Twitter. There is a narrative strength to being seen as a future leader. I mean, God knows that's the only reason Shane Jones is still surviving in politics, is because a bunch of people were very strangely convinced that he had leadership qualities to him.
And all of them worked in the press gallery.
Well, yeah, and don't like they hate the working class. That's why they think he speaks to them. So there is just a narrative strength there, as Philip said. Yeah, Hipkins was the attack dog, scapegoat of the last Labour government, and that doesn't engender confidence. And at the same time, somewhat to contradict myself, I think if he'd kept a bit of the attack dog in him,
Yeah.
he would have done better, maybe not one, but that is his vibe. Like, Chris, lean into the fact that you can savage people. It's not nice,
We
it's not
pushed it at the time.
friendly. Just have a go. Just be like, nah, this guy's talking nonsense. Can you imagine an election campaign where someone was just routinely saying, Christopher Luxon's talking a lot of nonsense? He doesn't have the numbers, he doesn't have the facts, he's got a bunch of CEO waffle. Do you want to be called into an HR meeting instead of getting an actual government who cares about teachers and hospitals? Like, just, it's
That's
not my
great. That's a great
preferred type
line.
of politics, but fucking go for it, man.
That's a good line. And like the only time he sounded authentic in the last few months, 6 months at least, it was just the other day when he was being interviewed and he attacked, I can't remember who it was, maybe Ryan Bridge, and was like about ram raids. And they were saying, oh, like, what is this new government doing right that you were doing wrong? And he's like, well, the numbers were going down under us, but your NZME Tory mates wouldn't publish it. Like, that's the vibe. You need to be just
That's the
off
shit
leash,
people want to share
attack.
on TikTok, Chris.
I have been saying since 2021 that the left-wing parties and Labour in particular needed to become more antagonistic with the media in that way while establishing their own like media pipelines because of the institutional capture of the media by extremists. And maybe they're finally starting to wake up to that, but it just feels late, eh?
Well, there's also a problem specifically to the ram raids example, which is that Labour love having a competition with National about who's going to promise recruiting the most
I mean, it
cops, you
doesn't
know?
help. I mean, they get pulled into it, right? And they just don't need to. Final topic for the day, because I think we absolutely have to get to this. Once again, I think the only people covering it, Moana Maniapoto had Francesca Albanese on incredible work to get that happening in the New Zealand media space. Māori media, again, is going to be one of the saviors of Aotearoa. And then Mick Hall covered this as well, because the US has just sanctioned Francesca Albanese. Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, absolute lunatic, absolute psychopath, by the way, said, "Today I'm imposing sanctions on UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur." This is fucking insane. Like, that first sentence is insane. Francesca Albanese, for her illegitimate and shameful efforts to prompt ICC action against US and Israeli officials, companies, and executives. Excuse me? Like, What?
I was gonna say when we were talking about Starmer, like just the with the prescribing of Palestine action, and I was like, the point at which you've got headlines about cops arresting 83-year-old Anglican priests for speaking about Palestine, you've probably lost. But this is the same kind of thing. The point at which you're like, I am sanctioning a human rights lawyer for pointing out the thing that everyone can see happening.
Yeah.
Like, Marco, come on. What are you doing?
There's just no, I mean, again, like Western IRBO, international rules-based order is just fucking done. Like, and you know, it's always been about maintaining Western power. And I almost want to make a clearer delineation here at this point, because the Western bloc is, you know, starting to split, right? But there's this Anglosphere kind of scrambling now, US, UK, Canada, Australia, ourselves, to just try to ignore or support the genocide as much as possible. But rules-based order is kind of being revealed for what it is, a way for the US in particular to maintain power and control. And they were able to do that via the UN and via NGOs for a long time. And this situation is so horrific that those groups are now offside with US military power. And so the US is going after them. Haven't seen anything about it in mainstream news.
Yeah, I'm just gonna immediately say that I always think of Francesca Albanese as the good Albanese, and my comms take on her is that there's just something about the Italian accent, because, and I figured this out. I was working through this in my brain last night. It's the opposite of the Kiwi accent, because when we want to say some solid truths, we get very flat and very self-deprecating and very. Well, that's just not how it is. What are you talking about? But she's got that amazing bouncy Italian talking about no state has a right to exist and this is clearly a genocide. And there's just something in the English speaking brain that goes, I like this. This is authoritative to me. And it is, there's just an indignation to the accent that makes it so clear what she is saying is true. So I do love that. But also, I think there's. Another revelation here, which is that the international rules-based order doesn't work in the age of social media, like because they can't mediate the story through traditional media anymore. We are seeing the live streams and the video calls and the photos from people in Gaza every day telling their story. And despite the best efforts of platforms like Blue Sky to delete their accounts, they can't stop. That reality being thrown in our faces every time someone tries to pull the academic, but doesn't Israel have the right to defend itself? Because anyone can say, no, not if it means murdering babies, actually. And just having someone who has the credibility of the UN, however deserved or undeserved we think that credibility of that organization is, to have that title behind her and be saying, yeah, it's a freaking genocide. What do you expect me to say? How dare you keep coming at me with this accusations of anti-Semitism bullshit is just, she's just so refreshing and I love her and, you know, TikTok videos will not save the world, but there's something about the boost to your spirit you get from seeing someone say the truth so plainly and unapologetically that gives you the impetus to keep going, even though the fight seems so fucking impossible. And so, of course, when she then paints a target on American companies and says, hey, all these guys are profiting off genocide, did you know? They are going to freak the fuck out because she is. Not just attacking the narrative around Israel-Palestine, she is attacking capitalism, and it's great, and I love it.
Yeah, and it makes them look pathetic, right? It makes them look like they've lost control of the narrative, and that can only be good. At the same time, we're seeing this absolute acceleration of the genocide. You know, people are calling it a Holocaust now. The attempts by the kind of corporate NGO styled groups, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, being the US Israeli cutout, which has been murdering people seeking aid. And this is being reported in Israeli media pretty frequently, folks, but is not getting into Western backyards, not getting into Western mainstream media. The main reason for that is because it stops the Western electorates from putting pressure on their governments to change tact, and the Israeli entity, relies on US, UK, Australian, Canadian, and New Zealand support to continue existing. And so, if that's why you see this absolute demarcation between what's happening inside Israel, even in terms of what they're reporting, and the open like discussion of this by the right wing MPs, like we're going to kill all Gazans, right? Like we're going to put them all in a camp and exterminate everyone outside it. There is a very clear, identifiable, and very easy to find dual PR between these two things. The more recent one is that they are making a concentration camp in Gaza now, but they're just calling it a humanitarian area, so that's probably
Humanitarian
fine.
city. It sounds great. Cities have running
Wow.
water and electricity, you know.
And then if everyone who comes into that humanitarian area will have all their ID checked somehow, like if anyone has any ID at this point, to make sure that they're not Hamas. And then everyone outside of that area, they would have come to the area if they weren't Hamas, so everyone outside must be Hamas, and so they're targets for extermination. And
And
they've
it'll be
said that
such
is,
a great city, no one will ever want to leave.
oh, and they're not going to be able to leave. And they are saying this openly in Israel, and it's being reported on by Israeli media outlets, and we are yet to see any discussion of that in Western media. It's absolutely fucked.
She's amazing, right? Francesca is our collective cool auntie, I guess, on the international left. But I think Stephanie really hit on something important in her initial kind of description, which is that when she attacked the corporate accomplices, that's a step beyond the pale, right? Like you can use whatever kind of airy-fairy international humanitarian rights-based language you want, but until you start making things material, it's not really that threatening to the arbiters of power internationally, right? But talking about the Economy of Genocide report that she released was like, oh, you actually mean something? Shit, okay. Which is great, right? Like, that's if we had a functional international rules-based order, that's how these things should look. But if you think we have one, learn Mandarin and Portuguese, because the US is not going to be the leader of that international rules-based order, even when and if the Democrats win the next election,
Maybe Spanish, maybe
because
Spanish.
far out. I was thinking Brazil, but I mean, Spain and Ireland are the kind of notable exceptions in Europe to the, pro-genocide, pro-Holocaust turn, right? So yeah, look, there's nothing wrong with Spanish.
This is,
Learn
yeah, I mean, this
Spanish.
is why
Move to
I'm.
Bolivia.
This is one of the reasons I'm delineating, right, in terms of the Anglosphere and the West, because we are just reaching a point. Fantastic. Thank you for joining us, everybody, but particularly Philip. Thanks for co-hosting with me today.
Particularly me, that's right, Stephanie. You're very welcome.
And hey, let me finish.
No,
And
no, no,
to.
no, no. That's the end. That's the end of the sentence. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Kyle. It has been a real, it's been a tough time. It's been a difficult morning for me to
Look,
attend. I
mate,
appreciate it.
the
I
first
had to get up
half
at
of
a,
this.
excuse me, interrupting me. It was difficult for me to wake up at 8:45 and have a coffee. Really difficult. I really appreciate you sitting with us, listeners. That's been another episode of 1-200. We appreciate like, share, and subscribe. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
The first half of the episode wasn't about what we should be emulating. And taking a lead from these right-wing councillors. Thank you as well to Stephanie, more particularly than
Thanks.
Philip at this point.
Well, you needed some diversity hire to bring out the
Oh
to tick those boxes.
my God.
Fantastic. So if you like diverse opinions in your media,
And Philip.
listen to us. Thank you so much for listening this morning. Patreon, as I said at the beginning, in the summary, give us some funding, share, like, subscribe, get people on board, and we'll be back next week with more stuff.
If our faces are denied, live in a pointless life, but learning all your lessons, fucking politics, there's no distinction, words apart now. It's paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize across me or to stay. Cause I live amongst the people.